current state on 90.5 WKAR. If you haven't visited WKAR.org in our Give Now link, I would respectfully request you to do that. Without assistance, financial assistance, from caring listeners just like you, we might sound like any other radio station, but we sound different, and we sound different because of your financial support. WKAR.org. Please use the Give Now link, and we thank you. I'm Mark Bayshore. There's much to talk about in the city of East Lansing these days. The city council's putting the finishing touches on a budget for the coming fiscal year. The city's financial health team is talking about how to address about $100 million in unfunded legacy costs. And the long-empty former bank building at the corner of Grand River Avenue and Abbott Road is finally set to be demolished. East Lansing Mayor Mark Meadows joins us to share his thoughts on these and other issues. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Thanks for being here today. What's most notable about this new budget?
All our budgets must be balanced.
Correct, so, by course, law.
That's very notable that it is a balanced budget. The feds don't have that same requirement.
You're following the law.
And we're following the law, yes. I think that, in a time when we're challenged financially, largely because of the reduced contribution from the state, and I don't even know if I'd call it a contribution. There was a deal struck back in the 30s that, sent money towards local units of government in exchange for having a single tax on sales across the state of Michigan. Other states have local sales tax. We don't have that. So local units of government have a restricted ability to, gather money together from retail activity within their communities. And that reduction, which has been continuous from the state level, has put a lot of communities in financial distress. And, we've had to struggle with it. But, things are looking good. Our property values are going up. Property sales are taking place. Houses fly off the market. I mean, there are multiple offers for homes in the city of East Lansing. And I think that's a very good sign. And our revenues are increasing. So the budget this year is a solid budget.
You're spending more money next year than this year?
We are, and we're spending more money to provide more appropriate services for our citizens, but also to take into account that we do have inflation, and we have to, always have some increase in budget to meet those inflationary costs.
Is there any likelihood the council might pursue tax or fee hikes in the next year?
We'll see. I can't say that is off the table, only because we haven't had a complete report from the financial health team, and that was one of the issues they were to recommend to us. I think it's unlikely, but I'm not saying that it couldn't happen.
Part of the budget conversation on May 17th had to do with the parking fee schedule. One idea had been to extend parking fee hours all the way to 3 a.m. Where does that stand?
We did do that. We extended parking enforcement to 3 a.m. as soon as we have these smart meters installed. And what that means is, Mark, that when you're sitting there with your wife at the Black Cat Bistro and you say,
at 3 a.m.
At 2 a.m. as usual. And and you say, oh my God, they've got, I think the meter might be running out. You can actually take your smartphone and put more money into the meter. And so when we have that capability, yes, we're going to run the meters until 3 a.m. and only in certain areas. For instance, over on Valley Court, our business is along Valley Court. There's no option there to park in a parking structure where you have, you can take your car off the street and not worry about overextending time on a meter. So we've excluded that particular area.
When do those smart meters go in?
Should have those smart meters in by the end of the summer, maybe even by August.
I know your city manager, George Lahanas, has discussed a proposal to place a bond issue on the November ballot to fund parks and recreation. It got some support, and there were others like you who I think took a more cautious approach. You want to hear from the financial health team, I take it, before deciding. Why the caution there?
Well, I think that, we put together a financial health team to make a lot of recommendations to us. Just simply replacing a bond that we use to construct athletic facilities and recreational facilities in the community, you know, maybe we'd want to use that opportunity to do other things like resurface our roads, which people are complaining about. So I think that, number one, it wasn't a good idea to just say we're just replacing this to do the same thing we were doing before. But, you know, we didn't have a discussion or even a study to determine whether an additional bond or renewing this bond should be used in terms of funding other activities.
Other projects, yeah. Okay. Speaking of the financial health team, what are they contributing here to the budget talks? How involved are they?
Well, they aren't really involved in this budget because this budget we just adopted last week. But the idea was for the financial health team that by next year's budget time, because their final report is due to us in December, by next year's budget process, we would be able to utilize their recommendations to determine where we would go to make sure that the city remains a financially stable community. And, you know, one of those things might be, you know, we should have a report from them by the end of July on legacy costs, for instance. And legacy costs are pensions plus what we call OPEB, other post-employment benefits, which would be health care generally. And so those two things are different. So about $70 million in unfunded liability on the pension end, $30 million on the OPEB end. We are not required by the Constitution to actually provide OPEB. So it's an entirely different issue to be discussed. But in terms of the pensions, we are required to do those pensions. And, you know, once they are granted, that's a contract between the community and the individual, which the Constitution protects. And so those we have to deal with differently. I know that the financial health team is discussing bonding, which is permitted under state law, to eliminate the unfunded liability in there. I don't think that we actually have the ability to fully bond at $70 million. We have a bond limit, which I think is at about $60 million. The major portion of that is public safety pensions. You know, in East Lansing, about $46 million of that $70 million relates to police and fire pensions.
The city does offer retirees, though, under the OPEB part of the ledger here, the city does offer retirees post-employment, retirement health care.
Correct.
And that falls under the OPEB. That falls under discretionary, correct?
That is. That was actually a lawsuit brought by MEA several years ago, and the Supreme Court ruled that it wasn't required to be given. So now, it wasn't the same as pensions.
Do you think the financial health team might come back with a recommendation to cut that or eliminate that or tinker with that in any way?
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, we haven't asked them to make a recommendation in terms of tinkering. But those are, you know, for instance, we just recently renegotiated our contract with McLaren. So we reduced our costs in that area. So when we get we're having this whole issue reviewed by MERS at this point in time. We should have a report by the end of June that updates our numbers, and it will update the OPEB numbers. Those may go down, actually. So
I know Council Member Ruth Beyer is impressed with some of the credentials of the people on the financial health team. You appear to have some pretty significant brain power on this panel. Are you encouraged by the contribution that they are going to make?
Yeah, I am. I think that it's going to be very useful to the city going forward, and I'm glad that we did it this way. And, you know, if the time comes when we need to reconstitute it, I'm fully supportive of the idea that we continue this use of expertise in recommending our options in going forward. The objective is to have the city financially stable, and we're going to do whatever we can to make sure that happens.
Mark Meadows is the mayor of East Lansing. We are talking about the city budget and other issues. When will the bank building at Grand River and Abbott come down?
You know, it could come down sooner than December 31st. That bank building must be down by December 31st. So You know, there are some people in the community who have said, you know, that's a great New Year's Eve party to watch the building come down. But I'm hoping that it's down before then. But I wouldn't mind having a community party, you know, regarding that. But the limitation on that is that, you know, it can be done sooner. As soon as we resolve an issue that we have with the state of Michigan regarding some tax credits that have been promised for that property over a period of time, those are at issue right now because of the delay in getting anything done on the corner. But the new owners of that property were just in this week with a sketch of a building, a hotel that they want to put up on that corner. And I think that, you know, that'll be going forward sooner rather than later. So you could see that building actually come down.
Remind us who owns the property.
It's a group out of Chicago. And I apologize if I have the wrong acronym here, because it's either DDR or DHR. It's a property development group that is self-funded, so they have their own money that they utilize. We don't have some of the issues that we had associated with that property in the past. They're very enthusiastic about the area. They've talked about this building on the corner being the first building that they would construct in the area. And then they've also talked about some plans with regard to the interior of the property, which, you know, includes those two apartment buildings, which will be down by the end of July. And I might add that the little bank building that the DDA owns, that property should be done. That should be down by mid-July.
I love the idea of a New Year's Eve demolition party.
I think it could be fun.
That would generate a lot of talk and some attendance, I think. More reasons to celebrate. You suggested to current state, I want to say as early as the day after the election last November, that you and others wanted to pursue development differently in the future. And in a nutshell, I took that to mean deals that are less favorable to developers. Now, I'm led to believe that on Tuesday night, that approach seemed to play out regarding the White Oak development. This is the site of the old Tasty Twist on Grand River. Can you talk to us about the arrangement that the city agreed to with, this is developer Joe Goodser, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Did that philosophy play out in what happened on Tuesday night?
Yeah, I think it did. You know, there was a dynamic there that probably some council members didn't even expect. You know, there was general dissatisfaction or distrust, I would say, in the community. When I was going door to door, that I would receive relating to the tax increment financing deals that were cut with some developers in the downtown, particularly in relation to the construction of residential housing for students that's close to campus. I think the perception in the community is that that is very valuable housing and it doesn't need any incentives, that it's going to fill up immediately. Students want to be closer to campus, and you know, I think that that's pretty obvious, actually. Joe's project, which is a six-story building, is if it goes forward, would start a signal additional density along Grand River closer to campus. And particularly in his project, you know, it is student-oriented construction. So there were a couple of members of council who didn't feel that it needed any incentives, and there were some that felt that, you know, it did need incentives. My viewpoint was
it was a unanimous vote, though, wasn't it?
It was a unanimous vote. And my viewpoint was that we limited our, in this case, brownfield, to the actual cost or the actual predicted cost of an environmental cleanup there, which was a serious environmental cleanup. There was a gas station there. That gas station did leak. It did get all the way to the Red Cedar River at one point, but was drawn back, you know, maybe 15 years ago. And so it needs to be taken care of. So this money that we awarded to him is to take care of that. He gets reimbursed on it over a period of time. The uniqueness of it was that we went 30 years, the maximum number of years that we can do it. That increases the tax value for the city in terms of tax revenue. It also provides a appropriate and reasonable tax increment financing for the individual, in this case, Mr. Goodsir, over a 30-year period, which should do well for him over that period of time. It also might be the biggest tax increment financing in terms of value that's ever been done in the city.
We're just about out of time, but I got to ask one more
question. Sure.
Could more deals like this, less generous to developers than in the past, slow down development? I mean, could developers stop looking at East Lansing as a good place to launch a business?
You know, I've got two hands in front of me. I can tell you right now, there are more than I can't. I need another hand to count the number of deals that are coming to us at this point in time. So all I can tell you is it doesn't seem to have said to any developer, don't come here and don't try to develop.
Mark Meadows is mayor of East Lansing. He's been talking with us about the city's 2017 fiscal year budget and other issues, development and others facing the city council and city manager George Lahanas this summer. Mark Meadows, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And coming up on Current State, Lansing's been experiencing population growth in recent years, but what are the reasons? And how can we do better and attract more talent? We'll explore those questions and more with Eric Dimoff, Director of Marketing and Communications at the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, and Chris Sell, the founder of Lansing 501. That's on the way. East Lansing's Broad Art Museum is about to welcome its next director, the Swiss-born curator, Marc-Olivier Waller. Current State's Jamie Paisley sat down with the longtime curator and art critic to learn more about the person at the helm of this new MSU landmark. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there, Mark. When I sat down with Marc-Olivier, it was, you know, in his new and very empty office. You know, obviously, he doesn't start his new job until July officially. But I was curious about something that, you know, everybody else pretty much faces as well, that job application process, particularly for such a high-profile position. How was the process of becoming the director of the Broad? How did they approach you, or how did that whole long path begin?
Yeah, I think it's specific to the United States. I mean, it exists elsewhere, but here it's more like headhunters that contact you, and then you go through the whole process with them. So it's very interesting. It's a different process than in Europe, where, you know, they approach you, but the museum is approaching you. They ask you to send some material. You make a proposal, and then you have an interview if you have, like, shortlisted to the last four, and then you have 1 hour interview, and that's it. Here it's different. It's like 2 days of interview starting in the morning, you know. I think it's very interesting. It gives you opportunities to say different things, to go to a much deeper level, I think. And I of course, it's more efforts. But I appreciate this approach, I have to say.
Is it also different because the Broad is attached to Michigan State University and just a museum attached to university? I don't think in your past, have you ever had an association like that before?
I mean, with university, I always work with universities. Even when I started created my first art center in Switzerland, I always worked closely with not only university, but any research structure. Could be private structure. I worked with, for example, the research team of Ducati, the motorbike, or with specialized infrared camera working for Hollywood. Not linked to university, but always linked with research. And of course, university, but mostly with like philosophers, sociologists, and when it comes to scientific research, most of the time was with private labs, but, you know, for me, it doesn't make any difference.
In your mind, is there a big difference between being a curator and just being essentially an evangelist for art?
Well, yeah, there is a big difference. An evangelist has, I mean, hopefully, met the truth, you know, somehow, somewhere. You know, he encounter some transcendental experience, and he wants to share it. A curator, once you deal with contemporary art, but I mean, once you deal with philosophy, with any type of art, you know there is no such a thing as one truth. There are many, which means this is what I call the schizophrenic caution, when a good artwork can bear many types of interpretation. And the more layers of interpretation you can bring on an artwork without it to fall apart, then it's a good artwork. If you have one, two interpretations, maybe it's just like an ordinary object. Three, four, maybe a good design object. Five, six, 10, 20, then it starts to be a very interesting artwork.
When you have those multiple layers of meaning, for the most part, I would say that that art has those meanings at that time that it was created, but as time goes on, people tend to lose that perspective of the full layers that are going on. How do you look forward while dealing with art that's created in that moment?
Well, when you talk with artists, I mean, strategically, sometimes they come up with one interpretation because it's a key access. It's an access key that gives you, you know, like a way to understand what the artist wants to do. But if you say to the artist, I see this work in this way, they say, yeah, good for you. You know, like you just need a good key. You know, it's just a question of building doors to enter the building. The important thing is you go in and then you visit the house. So I think that is important. And historically, I mean, masterworks have always been works that renew its interpretation. Think about Marcel Duchamp, for example. Every 10 years, from any decade in the 20th century, artists rediscovered Duchamp through the lens of surrealism, through the lens of conceptualism, through the lens of any different interpretation. Duchamp was always there. And that's the mark of a masterpiece. An artwork that always renews always his interpretation.
After you left the Palais de Tokyo in Paris and you founded the Chalet Society, and now you're coming back into established museum, what are the lessons that you're taking from that in order to move kind of curation and museum partnerships forward?
Well, for me, after Palais de Tokyo, I was wondering, okay, now if I have to take over another institution, what would it be? And I didn't have any answer. So I thought, you know, like, what's the best? And if you have the chance of creating from scratch a contemporary art institution, what it would be? I didn't have any answer. So I thought, okay, why not like creating your own structure that would allow you to test new ideas, new challenges? Because one thing is sure, nowadays, everybody in the art world is aware that the museum, as we know it today, is going to change. I mean, the museum has been, until now, based on a model from the 19th century, even like 18th century. Hasn't changed much. But nowadays, with the new challenges, technological challenges, social challenges, political challenges, the museum, and economical, of course, the museum is going to change. How, we don't know, but I mean, what is interesting is having a structure that allow you to test all these issues. So the Chalet Society is born with this idea of being able to test. So it's a lab that starts from the idea of what if we consider the museum not as a hardware anymore, like a platform, but as a software. What does it change in our way of doing things? So that's the challenge. That's what we have tried to test over the year, testing the notion of the artwork, testing the notion of the artist, testing the notion of the exhibition, and the last test is testing the notion of the institution. And once I've done that, for me, I was ready to go back to the institution with that type of experience.
In the history of the Broad, obviously it was a little more than a year ago that the founding director, Michael Rush, passed away. Did you know him, or did you have a conception of his vision as he began and obviously didn't finish what he had kind of started the path on?
I never had the opportunity to work with him, unfortunately. But that's one thing is sure. I mean, everything I will do here is influenced by his vision. He's the founding director. He started the identity of the Broad. So my challenge, my role is to take this vision and see how to bring it to the next level, which of course would correspond also to my vision. So without changing anything, trying to understand and see how it could evolve. Also, you know, like with the new artists, the changing technologies. So it's a work in progress.
Marc-Olivier Waller, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for being here.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, in many parts of the world, insects are viewed as an important food source. Now, America's not one of those places, but a conference this week in Detroit seeks to overturn that notion. We'll talk with MSU food scientist Dr. Jeff Swada about edible insects. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State every weekday at 9 and 6, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM. You can catch us at noon, Monday through Friday, on AM 870 and anytime at WKAR.org. It's the season for the birds and the bees, regardless how you might interpret that rich phrase. Last evening at Lansing's Robin Theater, storytellers shared their true first-person stories on that theme. Kathleen Veith remembered the confusion of her mid-1960s Catholic school sex ed instruction. Today's chapter, The Rhythm Method.
Well, the only method of contraception even hinted at was the rhythm method. Now, it was an aha moment for me because finally I understood why there were so many huge families at Mass on Sundays hogging two pews because the rhythm method does not work. The nuns would always be admonishing us girls never to allow a date to take us to a restaurant with white tablecloths. Girls, it will remind them of bed sheets and they will want to take you to bed.
More great first-person true storytelling at our next event, Wednesday, June 29th, at the Allen Marketplace. Our theme will be Putting Down Roots. We want to thank Kathleen Veith, who was our storyteller there, by the way. Thank you, Kathleen. But plan to join us in either listening or telling mode. That's Wednesday, June 29th, at the Allen Marketplace, Putting Down Roots. More information on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. The city of Lansing has experienced population growth for the third straight year. Mayor Virge Bernero has said that the city's aggressive approach to attracting new job-creating investments and making Lansing a more attractive place to live, work, and visit and play, that's a big long quote, has helped generate this growth. The Central Michigan chapter of the Public Relations Society of America recently held a panel discussion about the efforts being made in Lansing to retain and attract talent, business, and investment. Joining us in the studio to continue that discussion, Eric Dimoff, Director of Marketing and Communications at the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Eric's also a board member for CMPRSA, which stands for the Central Michigan Public Relations Society of America chapter, also joining us from that organization, and from Lansing 501, Chris Sell. Chris, good to see you again.
Good to see you too, Mark.
Eric, break this down for us here. How does the regional chamber and the Central Michigan PRSA, how do you work together here?
The chamber, along with our region's education and business leaders, really recognize the importance of having a strong and capable workforce, and that goes with having a strong regional brand and being able to attract and retain talent. Many of us, recognize it's one of the most important issues statewide and also nationally, and we recognize that it's going to be a deciding factor in our ability to bring and build a prosperous region.
Chris, explain the name Lansing 501. What does that mean? What's the vision for this organization?
Absolutely. So it's a volunteer-driven initiative. We convened as a group last fall with the support of the chamber and LEAP and the mayor's office. The mayor even spoke at our first meeting last November. There's about 13 of us, mostly young professionals in the community that are really passionate about helping connect young people, young adults, college students, young professionals to downtown Lansing and all of the wonderful live, work, play aspects of the Lansing region. And I think Lansing 501, the name kind of plays off this tagline that Lansing really does stay alive after five, much like the mural in downtown Lansing. So that's kind of the idea with Lansing 501.
But talk to us about your focus on interns and internships here.
Yeah, so specifically, we've partnered with 21 different employers, companies, organizations in the greater Lansing community and kind of struck up this partnership. And we are offering three events this summer, specifically downtown Lansing that are catered towards college students, specifically interns. And so just between the different 20 plus companies, there are over 500 interns that are living and working here in the greater Lansing region that can come to our three events for free. And those events are meant to be fun, educational, and really kind of help college students learn about all of the fantastic, really dynamic living options, entertainment options, all the wonderful things that are happening in Lansing.
Eric, you were recently the moderator for a CMPRSA panel about Lansing. What were some of the topics that arose in that discussion?
It really focused around the Love Lansing brand, which has really kind of taken off here in the past 4 or 5 years. Like I said earlier, it really is just focused on the Love Lansing brand, branding our region as a place to live, work, and play, and being able to attract young talent to our area and keep them here and power our workforce for the next generation.
Talk to us about who the panel members were. I know Chris was one of them, but who else?
Sure, we had Chris. We also had Rachel Machado from the Gillespie Group. We had Joseph Quick from Michigan Works Association. We also had Chad Jordan from Cravings Popcorn. He's one of our favorites at the chamber. We had Sarah Parkinson from Lansing Economic Area Partnership. And we also had Chris over here. And we also had Cindy Brown from Hello West Michigan kind of give us some insight in how they're branding West Michigan as a place to live, work, and play. So
I'm curious what she in particular brought to the table. What can Lansing learn from West Michigan or Grand Rapids?
I think it's just, we really need to work together and collaborate and kind of stick together on this issue. It's really important. And, the main thing we really need to do is not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. We all need to be really involved in our community to make it, a strong community and a vibrant place to live. And, the main thing she really highlighted is just being consistent with your messaging and really nailing home that this is the place to be.
I'm speaking with Eric Dimoff, Director of Marketing and Communication at the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. Also, Chris Sell joins us, the founder of Lansing 501. Back to your efforts with internships here, Chris, at Lansing 501. Do you try to persuade employers to offer more internships? I mean, that is just one more connection. With every internship that's added, that's one more connection to Lansing.
You got it. Absolutely. So I should mention, too, my day job, so to speak, I work as an internship coordinator for the College of Natural Science here at MSU. And so I just get to live this every day, right? I mean, this is what I'm totally passionate about, and that is helping companies connect to talent. And we believe internship to be this critical learning experience that's also wonderful for the business community and adds to the economic activity in the region. So I'll give you an example. I mean, just one of the companies is a sponsor of Lansing 501, Outdoors Insurance, has over 75 interns just in Lansing alone this summer. So just in a 3-month period, over 75 college students participating in internships with one company. That's really, really dynamic. And so there's lots of companies in the region that have really robust internship programs. And we think it's, of course, a huge part of their talent pipeline, but it's also a really captive audience for ways that we can kind of help make it compelling story story for why Lansing's a great place to stay after college graduation.
I certainly see more online, more social media, a higher online profile, some very splashy type, colorful images of certainly on the Lansing 501 website, but other places as well. Is there a lot of energy there? Are we keeping more MSU graduates, for one notable example? Are we keeping more of those people in town at least longer? Is that actually happening?
Yeah, you know, I think we have a lot of momentum going right now, and we see companies like Jackson National and MSU FCU investing in our region, building specifically just to house their local talent interns and keep them here as a pipeline to come into their companies and give them that experience to really break into the professional world.
Chris, what do you think young people like on the Lansing, the Metro Lansing scene? Yeah. What do you think keeps them here? What are you promoting as the features of the landscape that you're really hoping will change minds here?
Yeah.
And dissuade somebody from going to Chicago and staying in Lansing instead.
I don't have enough time, right? I could do that every day, all day. But I think you mentioned the landscape. So figuratively and literally, the Lansing River Trail, just one shining example, a gem of this community that I think young people really appreciate. People want to live by the river. They want to live downtown. They like recreational opportunities. So we see more kayakers up and down the river. We see folks wanting to live downtown. We see folks wanting to go to a Lugnuts game. They want nightlife options, retail. And of course, I think already Lansing as a region has wonderful suburban communities, fantastic school districts all across the region. And so really it's kind of helping young people understand that this is a great place to start at their post-college career, and certainly a wonderful place to stay beyond that.
But the harder part of the question here, I mean, you can point to advantages and very nice features of the landscape and of carving out a Lansing lifestyle if you seek them out. But what are the challenges? Where are we lacking, Chris?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question, right? And so I think it's even more convincing more and more companies to have a presence downtown, because I think we see more and more young people wanting to work downtown, right? Quicken Loans Detroit, thousands and thousands of people working there. And so I think you can see that already just downtown Lansing. Now we have a couple different companies like Jackson National and now the MSU Federal Credit Union that have literally opened a workplace on Grand River Avenue because they understand that college students would love to have that working environment in an urban environment right across the street from campus.
Eric, if you could change one thing about Lansing that would just soup up the appeal of the town, what would you change?
That's a good question. Honestly, I think I would just encourage people to just, you know, be more active in promoting Lansing and the Love Lansing brand. A few people doing it doesn't make a difference, but if the whole community is really involved in promoting our region and that sort of thing, you know, I really think it bodes well for the future of our region and really branding it as a place to be.
I have to assume that the proximity of Michigan State is a very good thing. There here is a significant pool of young talent graduating from a four-year research university term after term after term. How do MSU grads figure in your efforts at retention, Chris?
Yeah, it's a critical part of it, right? You know, 3 miles separates the front steps of the Capitol building from a world-renowned research institution with 50,000-plus students. So again, the proximity and some of the things that other communities envy, we have that. We have the state's largest river running through our downtown. We've got MSU, the state capital, the insurance industry, and certainly healthcare is another big part of it, advanced manufacturing with the auto industry. It's enormous. And so I think we might even see beyond the summer programming as an extension of Lansing 501 that could specifically help MSU students, LCC students connect with Lansing and the greater region.
Briefly touch on the three events here you've got coming up to one last time, Chris.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark. So you can find all the information on our initiative at Lansing501.com, but specifically this summer we're offering three events. The kickoff event is June 14th, downtown Lansing next to the city market. There'll be nighttime kayak rides, farmers market, food truck rally, and a concert that's going to be headlined performed by Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers that evening, open to the public.
Okay. And more about the other two at Lansing501.com.
You got it.
Yeah,
yep.
Very good. And there are two in July?
So the second event is Thursday, June 30th.
It's actually June, that's right. And
yep.
The third one is in July.
You got
very
it.
Very good. Lots going on there. Lots of fun to have, courtesy of Chris Sell, founder of Lansing 501. We also want to thank Eric Dimoff for his contribution. Eric's Director of Marketing and Communications at the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. Best of luck. We'll have you back.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Have you ever eaten a bug? On purpose, that is. And childhood dares don't count either. In much of the world, edible insects are valued as a source of protein. They haven't quite caught on in the U.S., aside from the creations of a few daring gourmet chefs. But a conference underway this week in Detroit is considered the first of its kind ever held in the United States. It's called Edible Insects Detroit 2016. Michigan State University is also thinking about the nutritional value of insects. Joining me now in the studio, Dr. Jeffrey Swada. Jeffrey's an assistant professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition here at MSU. Jeff, welcome to Current State.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Kevin Lavery also joins me in the studio here, who helped arrange this segment.
Full disclosure, I just felt a sense of obligation and guilt. If I'm the one going to be making you eat the bugs, Mark, then I'm going to do it right along with you.
Okay. I appreciate the shared sacrifice is the best sacrifice here. Actually, I'm actually kind of looking forward to this in kind of a twisted kind of way. Most Americans, Jeff Swada, don't quickly think of insects as a food source. Why should people consider edible insects?
Well, you have to think about it as, you know, they're a very sustainable source of protein. The average insect, it's hard to get a good statistic, but it's about 2 to 4 times more protein than, let's say, a beef cattle, for instance. You get a higher level of iron, a higher level of calcium, so it's really nutrient dense.
That's per
quantity,
ounce,
you know,
per whatever.
You know, per gram.
Per gram, per ounce. Right.
Units really, it's all relative.
Okay.
Besides a nutritional point of view, I mean, just from an environmental point of view, a statistic out there, like 1 pound of soy protein takes about 250 gallons of water to grow, whereas the same amount of, you know, insect-based protein could be about a gallon. So in a place like California with the drought, you know, going on, this is a really sustainable form of, you know, long-term, you know, nutrients.
Very interesting. How did MSU get involved in the edible insect trend?
Well, I've always heard about it. You know, way back in 2013, the UN came out with their kind of, you know, edible insect report. And so I've kind of been, you know, following the current trends. And then
The UN did an edible insect report.
It was more just kind of a summary of the current state of what's going on.
Interesting.
You know, across the world. And so I've been up with that. And then a local company in Detroit, Detroit Ento, they're actually a cricket farm/processor. They're a startup. They want to figure out how do we partner with MSU to use our resources and actually help them, and they could help us. So we're starting up a kind of a collaboration with them. Helping with their research and helping with our research as well.
Well, before Kevin and I actually sample some of the items that you brought in here today, talk to us about the most commonly consumed insects around the world here.
Oh, around the world, there's tremendous variety. Here in the Western culture, not much. Crickets are probably as far as people go, maybe chocolate-covered crickets. In places like Thailand or, you know, different parts of Asia, they have over 1,000 different types of insects to eat. And it's
part of the culture in Thailand, for example.
Exactly.
It's not uncommon to meet people who.
It's much more part of the culture, and, you know, it kind of goes back to, like, I brought up the example of sushi, for instance. You know, 20 years ago, people thought raw fish in the Western culture was just disgusting. Now it's something everyone, you know, loves. It's just more of a kind of a social trying to understand, wrapping your mind around eating something we're not used to.
Well, let's, before any more time elapses, Kevin, dive in, shall we?
Let's crack open a cricket or two.
What's your pleasure? We have cricket cookies from a place called Biddy Foods.
I would just as soon warm up to the idea, kind of build up to
it's
an
kind
actual.
Of a progressive thing.
Exactly. It's a progressive dinner. Exactly. I'll start with
it's a movable feast, is what it is.
Life is short. Eat dessert first, right? Let's.
Start with cookies. Then we have salt and pepper mealworms. That could be your next course if you're interested.
Salt and pepper mealworms.
We also have barbecue crickets.
So I'm opening a package here. This is, the word cocoa is in this. It's hard to quarrel with that.
No, I have the mealworm package in front of me, Mark, but I'm not starting with that. I'm going to ask you to hand me a cricket cookie if you don't mind here.
Oh.
All right, we're going to give that a shot.
And I'm sorry, this is cricket meal?
Oh, it's cricket flour.
Cricket flour
they dry the crickets, and then they grind it up and make kind of a flour similar to what we understand as wheat flour. A little bit different properties. But
I imagine this would be a way to get people to, kind of an introduction to consuming what used to be a bug and consuming it in cookie form.
Exactly. I mean, you don't have to eat, I'm holding here the barbecue crickets. I mean, that's something you could snack on. But, introducing, flour into cookies or bread or tortillas, most consumers, if, you wouldn't tell them, they wouldn't know.
You don't happen to have a nacho cricket in your box there, do you, Jeff?
I have a...
Something is barbecued.
Barbecue cricket. That's kind of close.
Mm.
Yeah. If you want to try
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me.
Enough of this cocoa... I mean, this tastes like
it's not bad.
A lot of other cookies, and
it does
perfectly.
I mean, it's
perfectly good.
And most of the time, you'll get a textural change just because you don't have the gluten that you get from normal flour.
It's very very
but
subtle.
But the taste is
Where now again? You said Thailand in particular is a common. Where else in the Africa? For example,
there's
where else?
A very rough statistic, and this is don't quote me on this, but about 80% of the world's countries, it's a common practice to consume insects in some form. Okay. Now that's again a rough estimate, so it's kind of a lot of the other countries. You could think of it as maybe in Thailand, they have a certain basis of insects that they frequent. If you gave them something that they're not used to, they'll kind of freak out just like as Americans do too. But they're used to crickets. But if you give them maybe, some exotic spider, they might not be as inclined. So it's more of a social perception.
Why don't you pass out another sample here of what are you opening, Kevin?
Well, I'm opening a package of sea salt and pepper mealworms, and so we can get a sense of the...
what am I getting here, Jeff?
Open here. We'll try that out.
Oh, boy.
Okay, I'm not going to eat a whole lot of these, but I will eat a couple, I think.
Smoky barbecue crickets. I'm holding a bag of smoky barbecue crickets. How about that?
I have three very tiny sea salt and pepper mealworms.
Think of them as pork rinds. Just pop them down.
One, two, three.
He's nodding.
Mmm.
He's nodding.
Just like Mama used to make. Not bad.
I'm not a big fan of barbecue.
Yeah.
And I'm even less a fan of consuming. Oh, my gosh.
All right, throw me the barbecue cricket bag. I'm going to give it a try. You're not into the mealworms, Mr.
Bishore? Five crickets in my hand, and I'm going to open up my mouth and put one of them in.
It's not so bad.
Just chew them up nice.
Just chew them up nice.
This is one situation where you have to kind of eat with your mouth open just to get that radio effect. So
exactly. Nice crunch.
Forgive my lack of social graces here. I am now attempting to ingest some barbecue crickets. Here we go. Yeah.
I'm going to put down four at once. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay. Jeff, do you consume crickets yourself, or do you just preach the gospel?
No, I've actually passed them out to my course I teach last semester to the whole class. I mean, I don't consume them on a daily basis, but I'll have them for a snack every once in a while.
Where can you buy them?
Very few places in the U.S. There's places like Biddy Foods, which I mentioned. There's an Ento Market. They're all online-based companies. You can buy them. They're all over the place in Thailand. I chose to do more U.S.-based companies that are approved by the USDA just so you know, we're safe as possible. But I mean, within the U.S., it's basically online,
mm-hmm.
Right as of now.
Well, I'm cribbing a line from Saturday Night Live, but I still remember the Bass-O-Matic, and I'll just say, that's cricket. We want to talk. We want to thank Jeff Swada, assistant professor in the Department of Food Science and Nutrition at Michigan State University. This week, Detroit hosts the first conference of its kind in the U.S. entitled Edible Insects Detroit 2016. It runs today through Saturday at Wayne State University. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That wraps up our program here for today. Tomorrow on Current State, an encore program. Tune in for the best of Current State, that and more, Friday here on WKAR's Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. Forgive the smacking of lips here. I need more of those crickets. The Current State podcast, your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day. It's Current State on WKAR.